Welcome to Journalism History, a podcast that rips out the pages of your history books to re-examine the stories you thought you knew and the ones you were never told. I'm your host, Terry Finneman, guiding you through our own drafts of history. This episode is sponsored by the Grady College of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Georgia. For more than a century, Grady College has educated students to relentlessly pursue the art, science, and integrity of stories. They are committed to following First Amendment principles in a digital-first environment as they prepare democracy's next generation. This episode discusses best practices for directing a historical dissertation or thesis, as discussed at an American Journalism Historians Conference. Panelists are Maureen Beasley, Julie Williams, Ernest Perry, Rachel Grant, and Dave Davies.
I was just delighted when Dave asked me to be on this panel and come forth out of retirement, because this is a subject that I've given a lot of thought to. I have had a lot of experience with advising, and I want to really tell you a story. I don't want to overtalk my time either, because you got a lot of other people who have very interesting things to say to you. Well, I want to tell you about a story. This is about a young woman who was very uncertain of what she was doing. She had a job, she wasn't sure she was going to stay with it, she wasn't sure whether she was going to move on. She had a marital situation she wasn't sure she was going to stay with either. And she also was enrolled in this PhD program at a university where she had a male advisor. He was never particularly helpful. And finally, she became a feminist and thought, well, maybe I should see through him. There's a lot of psychology involved in dealing with advising, with all the personalities you come in contact with. So she said to him one day, sir, we were always very formal, perhaps you don't think a woman should get a PhD. Perhaps you think she should teach at the community college level and not worry about a PhD. Oh, he just smiled. Like, you have seen the light. And I said, yes, thank you, sir. Well, okay. Now, Title IX came along, affirmative action came along, and this university, and I'll tell you the name, George Washington University in Washington, D.C., got sued, not once, but twice or several times, for not hiring women and minorities. So they managed to lure away from Howard University a woman who had a degree from Harvard named Letitia Woods Brown. And so Letitia came over to this program at George Washington University in American Civilization. And there were a few of us, really had very few PhD students anyway. So why so-and-so would want to discourage anyone, I don't know, but he did. She became the advisor of this young woman. And this young woman thought she would go into African-American studies because she had a minor in that field. Letitia, an African-American, said, you know, I don't think that's a very good idea for you because I think the primary source material you will need is going to be kept in various archives and they really aren't going to let you see them. I said, okay. This young woman said, okay. Letitia said, well, let me think about it. And so the next time the young woman met with Letitia, Letitia said, you know, I sat up in bed the other night and I said to my husband, I've thought of something for that girl to do. Why don't you write about Washington women travelers in the 19th century? And you just go to the Library of Congress and look up what they wrote, okay? She went to the Library of Congress and she began to read a lot about women's views on 19th century journalism, and she began to find that there were a lot of women involved in 19th century journalism in Washington who had been previously overlooked. And so she wrote a dissertation about that. Well, I'm sure you figured out the young girl was me. And I really wanted to be here today due to David's kind invitation, because I wanted to thank Letitia Woods Brown for what she did for me. I would never have finished if I hadn't had an advisor who cared enough to sit up at night and say to her husband, well, I've thought of something for her to do. Letitia was a wonderful woman, and the last time I saw her, she was dying of breast cancer. And I didn't know that. And so I was complaining to her about some other problem I had with a job I had at the time. And I've been embarrassed about it ever since. And so I want to publicly confess to her, and I'm sure she's up there somewhere, that if it hadn't been for her, I wouldn't have had 40 years in academia. I have done a lot of advising of students. I have one of the advisees right here. And I have tried to remember what Letitia taught me, which is you really have to care about the students or you aren't going to be very successful. Thank you.
Okie dokie. She's right. You have to care. Now, I advise undergraduate senior theses, which is to say, it's not the holy grail to them that a master's student, they might have looked ahead at someone else's thesis and thought, I'm gonna get a bound book out of it. It's gonna be, you know, I'm gonna get it, take it home and show it off. This is just another flaming hoop for them to jump through as far as they're concerned. So having taught two sections of this for 20 years, two sections a year for 20 years with about 8 to 15 students each time, I've figured out some tips. And that's what I'm gonna throw at you. How do you deal with this massive group of undergrads who don't really see this as the Holy Grail? So, gotta get my glasses on to read them. I have to start with, this is not a term paper. You cannot dash this off in the last 2 weeks. You'd be surprised how many still think they can do that. Then I'm gonna say, you're not writing a long magazine article. There will be no interviewing and no photographs here. And you should see the, and I said, there will be no documentaries made near. You know, because I say, look, you already know how to do that. This is a new genre. This is a different genre called original research. And it's not journalistic research. Journalistic research is not original research. And then you get, and they get all upset. And I say, no, I'm not saying that you're not original when you do journalism. And I have to praise journalism, which I do. I think journalism is incredibly valuable. But as I say to them, as a journalist, when a news event happens, you have to say, I can of mine own self know nothing. I have to go to an expert, and the expert has to explain it, and it's my job to funnel that through in a way the public can understand, and it's a high, high public service. But this way, you're going to the original documents if it's history, opinions if it's a survey, reactions if it's an experiment. You're going to the original, and you're becoming the expert, and they kind of get that. And so then they have to be told, well, what is original research? Because they all come in thinking they're going to write a big magazine article, which they already know how to do. So I go through all the different genres and mainly emphasizing what I won't do. Like, they can't do a trend study, not enough time. They cannot do anything with minors, not enough IRB space. You know, they can't do anything that will get me fired, like the young man who wanted to record a soft porn movie and get kids' reactions to it. No, I put my foot down. They turn in their idea, and most of them come into you with their idea with, like, I'm going to do a survey, and I'm going to do some historical research, and I'm going to do that, because they hear it has to be 15 pages minimum. Now, the secret is, I've only had two in all these 20 years that came in at 15 pages. Most are 25 to 35. I have no upper limit. And they're just astonished when I say, choose one. And then you have to really discern what their heart is. Just like Maureen was saying, you have to figure out where their heart really is so they can really latch onto it. And they usually come out of your office dancing because they only have to do one of their six ideas, which is great. then they have to do a lit review on their idea. Now, here's why I specifically differ from my master's training. I remember doing a literature review that took all semester. It was 20s of some long 25, 30 sources and on and on. All right, this is not going to happen in a one semester class with kids who aren't interested in that. That I tell them they have to have 5 scholarly sources, and no, you know, they don't have to go anymore. Some do, but you know, that's it. And then also, I have this philosophy of lit review, and I know there are various ones, but I say, what we're trying to prove is that nobody has done your topic before, because if you're just reporting on what someone else has done, you're not doing original research. You're back in that term paper, right? And some of them get frantic, but I point out, like, well, let's say you want to look at World War II ads. We can all name a bunch of articles we've read about World War II ads, but I'll say nobody's written about the ads in our student newspaper in World War II. Oh, and they really can grab hold of that pretty well, but I limit that lit review because the fun part is yet to come. Now, grading the lit review is another bear. I used to say, oh, that's good for a first try. Let me give you a B- on that. Now you need to fix all this stuff. Well, they'll say, I got a B-. I'm happy. Goodbye with that part. So now I have to grade it realistically. I'll tell them, I'm giving you the real grade you get if this is the last day of class, and they're coming up with some D's and some D+'s, and they're really upset. And I'll say, but wait, you have coming up your prospectus, your first draft, and your final draft. And if the final draft is perfect, it gets an A. So it gives them kind of an incentive and a little realism at the same time. That has worked. That finally is the formula that worked. And then they have to write a prospectus. Very easy for the qualitative people. I just have to make sure they really can get their hands on Life magazine in 1936 and that it really does have what they want in it. But the quantitative ones, you got to work with them. And is this survey question really worth it? You know, have you asked enough? Have you asked too much? Those are a bear. But anyway, when the qualitative ones are approved, I'm the only approver on that, they have a month and a week to get their first draft in. And you have to write them. You have to remind them. Then the quantitative ones have to go through IRB, which every year gets worse and worse at our school. Very difficult, takes a lot of time. And so I tell them, the minute you get the okay from IRB, you hit send on your survey. Just hit it send now. And you'd be surprised how many, oh, I was going to do that next week. Oh, I forgot. I'm like, no. You've got to write them because they have a limited time and limited understanding of how much analysis and all they have to do. So then they come in with their first draft. Now, I've adopted a schematic for grading that some will go, oh, you all will do that. But what I finally decided, I realized that you can't just say to them, you got a lot of grammar errors here. And they'll go, what? Because they're journalists. They think they know grammar. So I've finally taken to correcting the grammar, just ding, ding, ding. And I try to explain the repeated errors. You know, this, we're going to have to fix this. You're doing this all the time. But sometimes I just take out their comment, don't even mention it, because I've decided that I'm kind of adopting the position of I'm no longer your sort of adversarial teacher, I'm now your sort of teacher editor. So I'm trying to get it looking into shape, but the real problem comes in analysis. They will almost never do enough analysis. Well, all but two in all these years have not done enough analysis. So what I do is I read along until I get to the first analysis I can really get a hold of, and I flip the paper over. I make them print out of the front side only for that reason, and I start writing it how it should sound. I'll say, based on the data you have, here is what you should be saying, and I'll do the analysis on that sample, and I'll do another one. And depending on the length, I might do one more. Then I'll get tired of doing that, and then I'll start listing bullet points. I think you need to talk about this, this, this. And by the time I'm at the end, I'm too tired to do it. I'll say, you need to do what I told you to do on the back of page 6. Now, the good ones will take that and run with it. They come in with some great stuff. They get it, you know. The mediocre ones are falling all over themselves with gratitude for, they say, oh, that's exactly what I wanted to say, but I didn't know how to say it. And then they will be coming to you every week with another paragraph they've written begging, is this okay? But, you know, that's okay. I'm all right with that because they realize what they need to learn, and they've got into the idea of I'm learning, I'm figuring this out. And they usually are able to chip away at it in a pretty meaningful way. They're pretty good. The bad students, they'll correct what you wrote on those first two or three, and they'll never go back to it. And then they'll get bent out of shape when they get a bad grade at the end. But that has worked a great deal because I discovered it's no good to make them guess. They have no idea what they're talking about because it's such a new genre to them. They've not looked forward to anybody else. They've read the few articles in the Lit Review, but they're really mystified. And so the idea is to kind of become somewhat of an editor with them as opposed to an adversary. And they generally come out with a paper that they're pretty proud of. And they're, you know, some of them have used in applying for jobs and such like that. And I believe I've actually gotten in the time limit. Dun, I think I've done it. So anyway, those are my tips after many scores and scores of students, how to get through the large number, you know, and it kind of works. So I'd be happy to talk with you further if you advise undergrads.
Good morning.
Morning.
So my role on this panel is to discuss how to help students produce interdisciplinary master's thesis and dissertations. And this is something that, you know, I have a lot of experience in because the majority of the students in our program at Missouri do interdisciplinary work because of the way we're set up. So then because we were talking earlier and we kind of wanted to make sure that we left a lot of time for discussion, so I'm just going to go through a couple of points here, and then I'll talk a little bit more about them in the question and answer session. One of the things that the first things that is key in terms of interdisciplinary master's thesis and dissertations is making sure that you have contacts in other parts of campus. And our program is interdisciplinary across the board. So we have four major research areas: media sociology, strategic communications, media history, and then law, policy, and ethics. And we also have both formal and informal connections with history, with English, with education, with sociology, with law, so with other programs on campus. And what that does is that helps us in working with those programs to get our students into those classes, especially when it comes to methodology. Okay. One of the things that we really push is for our students to not only learn the methodology within our own unit, but also methodologies outside to make that much broader connection. So I have a student right now who's working on researching journalists who were vital to the formation of the house organ for the Southern Baptist Convention. Okay, and in her coursework and in her work, where she is right now, she's ABD, she's working on her dissertation. But prior to that, she was taking class. She was working with a media sociologist. She was working with someone in who's doing historical sociology. She was working with someone from history who is a scholar in Southern culture. And then she's also working with the civil rights historian. And one of the time periods she's looking at is the civil rights movement. So she's been able to pull all of that together through coursework and through connections that we have in the school to build out this sort of interdisciplinary type of dissertation. And so in moving from that, it's getting students, the other part of this is getting students to understand, and faculty, that the media is not the center of the universe. There are other parts that play into it. Because oftentimes students will come in with a narrow idea that's one-dimensional, especially when they're thinking about a media topic and they center solely on the media and not everything that sort of pulls into that. So getting them to take a multidisciplinary approach in developing their ideas that can lead to either an interdisciplinary thesis or an interdisciplinary research, that it builds on a larger picture that reflects the multidimensional cultures and societies that the media operates in, and in the role that plays in not only the media's relationship with that, but also, and this is when we start talking about building out a much larger research portfolio that goes past the thesis and the dissertation, is that understanding that methodology and understanding how the other parts of the academy can actually help you to be a much well-rounded scholar as opposed to just being in this finite sort of area. So the main part to me is trying to get the students to be able to build a bridge between who we are and what we do as media historians, and how does that fit into the other areas of history. When you start talking about sociology, you start talking about law, you start talking about even business history, we have a connection there. So how do you build that out? So the other part to that is, it also creates an opportunity for the students to build a mentor-mentee relationship with someone who's outside of media history and can help connect them in ways that we don't even think about when we get into our smaller cliques. And that can help them to build out that build out their research and make it much more broader. And that sort of fits into one of the last things I want to talk about, which is, and I'm putting on my administrator hat here, is that, you know, we hear over and over again how the need to collaborate with other units on campus, especially when it revolves around how do you make those connections for grants? How do you make those connections for foundation funding? How do you make those connections when the budget starts getting cut and the provost and the chancellor starts talking about we need to take an interdisciplinary approach? A lot of that revolves around graduate education. And they're talking about, can your unit partner with another unit in doing research that can lead to increased citation metrics, that can lead to more funding in terms of grants and foundations? Your graduate students, whether you're talking about the coursework that they're doing, the dissertations or the thesis that they're doing, they all fit into that. And so when you start to think about interdisciplinary and making those connections, that is where it starts. And what it can lead to ultimately is that you have students who are coming out of the programs who have this interdisciplinary approach, and that can lead to foundation and grant proposals that stretch past your campus to other campuses because your students are out there. So they keep those same mentor-mentee relationships that we're fostering. So now we do interdisciplinary work, even on a history basis, with former students who are at other universities. So that keeps that pipeline going. So I think it's really important to stress that, because in the current higher education environment, if you're not collaborating with other units on campus, you stand a good chance of being marginalized. And one of the ways to do that is to have your students working with other faculty, other students, and other units to build out that collaborative environment. Thank you.
So hello, my name is Dr. Rachel Grant. I graduated from the University of Missouri. I'm here to provide the student perspective. Dr. Ernest Perry was my advisor for my dissertation. And I also did a historical master thesis as well. So my word of advice, I guess, to be piggyback and talk about what everybody else has kind of talked about. A lot of the relationship, at least for the student's perspective, is this a person I can trust that's going to actually, again, help me get through this process? I think there's a lot of fear of what this project is, because at that moment, the thesis or the dissertation is probably the biggest project you've ever done. So fostering that relationship really early is really important. Both times when I did my master's and my graduate, my dissertation, I remember several times before I even started writing or even thinking about actually what I wanted to do, there was a lot of conversations and a lot of telling me, no, you can't do that. Or, no, this is not the direction you want to go. Or, Dr. Perry likes to use the word, don't go down this rabbit hole. So I used to go down several rabbit holes. I think I was like, oh, I want to talk about NAACP. And he's like, how does that fit with Black female journalists? So having that conversation is really important early in the beginning. And then also, again, talking about the University of Missouri, it is a very interdisciplinary program. So I remember very early on, probably my second semester in the program, Dr. Perry and Dr. Mislam were already introducing me to people outside the program. So I was introduced to a historian in the history department who does Black history, particularly focusing on women, and then as well as meeting with somebody who does media sociology, because I knew I wanted to focus on the Cold War period, and that was the area that she was really involved and understood. She wrote a book on social movements. And I remember after we had kind of met these people, Dr. Perry was like, go introduce yourself to these people and ask them if they're interested in your project. And I was like, I have to ask them if they're interested in this project? But it really meant a lot to actually have people who actually are interested in what your students are doing. It made the process easier. I will say from some of my other classmates who did not do that process, there was a lot of struggle with your committee actually agreeing on what you're actually doing. So everybody kind of knew what their role and what their position and their insight was to the project. And so it made it very easy to not step on anybody's toes, to who to go, who knew the actual information, the resources that I needed, as well as having and taking classes with those professors after I decided what my topic was. So by my second year, I'd already decided that I wanted to use Black feminist theory in my paper, because we had already talked about that's what I wanted to do, focus on Black female journalists. So that second year, I was already in a class, and I was writing my, I basically wrote my theory part of my dissertation. Again, a very broad understanding of what Black feminist was, but I was able to pull that information and put it in my dissertation. I took a Black history, African American history class, and we did a state of field historiography, and I was able to do it on Black female journalists. So a lot of the work that I was doing interdisciplinary was able to already apply to the final project. Like, I hadn't done any archive work at all, but I already had my theory, I already had most of the historiography, the context. Then I took discourse analysis, which we had a conversation about doing discourse for my dissertation. And so I knew, so all these pieces were coming together. It wasn't until like the second semester, by the way, I completed my dissertation in 3 years, which if you met me in St. Petersburg, I didn't believe that was actually going to happen. Janice knows this because I was like, this man's crazy. I'm not going to finish this in 3 years. Because he's like, we're going to get this done. I'm like, I don't know. So basically by the second year, I knew what my topic was because we had had a conversation. We're like, we need to pick the topic. So I picked the case that I was going to focus on. And that summer, while studying for comps, I was actually started to collect archives and figure out what I wanted to actually collect the information on. Luckily, with technology and a lot of the topics that what I was covering, I was able to go and do a lot of get archive information from ProQuest, and then also a lot of this was digitized. And I went to the Schomburg, and when you go there, if you go to their library, they give you 3 months of free access of their digital archives, FYI, because it's amazing. And then also, I went to Emory. But these, again, the process very much was already very interdisciplinary. I already felt like I knew the knowledge for what my theory was. So I understood what Black feminist theory was, not just in the context of what media does, but also in the larger understanding of what that actually means, a larger breadth of knowledge. Same thing with history, with African-American history. I ended up receiving a graduate minor in Black Studies because I was already taking those courses in disciplinary and different programs. And then as well as the media sociology part, understanding relationships of power and how the media fits within that. And that was able to, again, add to my knowledge of what I was actually doing in my dissertation. So when it came to actually writing it, a big bulk of things I already had a very big knowledge or understanding of what that was because of the courses and the disciplinary work that we've already done. So basically, I just got to write the media part. So that was, again, which, you know, that's the part that it's very difficult, but you actually enjoy it more because it's not the theory and the methodology stuff. So, but that's what I would say. I think this just knowing that your students know that you could trust them, Dr. Perry still has to tell me it's going to be okay. Don't worry about it. Even though I don't necessarily think about it at that time, it usually turns out that way. And just being able to keep that mentor and mentee relationship, still doing research with Christina Mislon outside of the program, still communicating with the professor who's in history and working with her on getting my book prospectus done. So keeping those relationships in a very, I would say, interdisciplinary broad understanding is important. So that's all I have. So if you have any more questions.
Morning. Morning, I'm Dave Davies, and my part of the panel is to talk about topic generation with students. And I'll start by telling you about going to the Southeast Symposium in the mid-1990s when I was in mid-dissertation, and Dr. Sloan, I suppose, came up with the idea, David, why don't you give a presentation on this panel about doing your dissertation? And so I got, and of course, I was in that, I guess it's the research equivalent of your teenage years of your dissertation. I was in that awkward place where things were starting to move, but there was still enough uncertain that I wasn't exactly certain of which way I was going. And so the analogy I used in that presentation was, I feel like I've taken apart a bicycle and I'm about a third of the way toward putting it back together, but you know, I'm kind of having trouble with some of the remaining parts. Well, that analogy followed me for about 5 years after, and all the way till the day I'd finished my dissertation, people would say, how's that bicycle coming? So I wanted to talk about the particular part of the bicycle about topic selection, which I have always thought is one of the most, my most favorite parts of working with dissertation students on pulling together things. And looking at the folks in the room, I don't pretend that I'm going to be telling you too much that you don't already do, but maybe it's useful to talk about some of the things that I go over with students. Like Julie's, sometimes students come in with, they already have an idea. My wife, who's an archivist at University of Southern Mississippi and works in special collections, yes, pretty handy, I know. She deals with students who come in all the time, and they'll come in with these obscure ideas, and she says, you know, I want to do something on feminism in World War II prison camps. And Jennifer will say, well, we don't really have any sources on World War II prison camps. And so I think that's my biggest thing that I work with students to start out with is, are there sources in what you're interested in? And they don't necessarily have to be down the street. They don't necessarily have to be in the building next door in the archives, but they have to be something that's available to you that you're going to be able to get to, either on the internet or within the time constraints of your class or completion of the dissertation to get to that particular archives. So are there sources for this that are going to be able to shed some kind of light on all of that? And secondly, is it important? Julie mentioned the standard of has it been done before? And then I think in discussions with Julie, I've also heard her say that, well, if nobody's ever done a story, I remember this example specifically from one of your presentations, maybe nobody's ever studied spitting on the sidewalk in Birmingham in the 1880s, but maybe it's because that's not that important. So you have to go through that gentle dance of, is it an important enough topic? And even if it has been done, as Julie said, is there's a slice of it that you can take that hasn't been approached? And if it hasn't been done, ask yourself why not, and make certain that it's connected to a bigger question. The example I remember being explained to me was that there's the top of the pyramid where the biggest issue is at the top, and you want a slice of that at the bottom that sheds some light on that bigger issue, and sometimes that helps students as we think about that. The thing I really try to emphasize to them, though, in topic selection is to get out of the building. When I was in the newsroom, they would say to us, you're never going to come up with a great story staring out the newsroom window. You have to get out. Well, similarly, the students need to go to the library, look through some of the literature to try to get some ideas about where they're actually headed. They'll have a sense about what the sources are, and they'll have a sense about what's been done. I think a good place to start, particularly for a university like mine, and I'm sure all of yours, where there's plenty of cool collections in your archives, start with those collections. What about those collections might lead you toward topics, knowing full well that you have a source base right down the street? At Southern Miss, for example, we have the DeGrumman Children's Collection. We have everything related to children's literature virtually that's ever been done. It is the second largest collection of children's literature in the country. And I always tell students this, no, it's never resonated with a particular student, but by golly, I'm going to keep trying. Lastly, I would like to say that I think it's important to give students a sense about how to stay organized in all of this. And some of you in this room have been subjected to my 60-minute style questioning of how did you organize that project? Because I'm really interested in how each of us go about the business, not only of collecting the information, but keeping it organized by topic and whatnot in order to put that bicycle back together at the end. You all have your own secrets. You've talked to other folks about their secrets, about putting things together. But I think it's kind of surprising how little time as a discipline in media history and in American history, we spend actually talking to students about how to organize a huge amount of information. For most of these students, they've only done maybe term papers before now, and for the first time, they're having to do something large scale. You know, for some of us, the least organized among us, myself included, that those kinds of tips on staying on organizing the material can prove really useful. And then lastly, talking about rabbit holes, I got to touch on the rabbit hole. I really try to, like Ernest, try to keep my students from going down the rabbit hole of different topics. As what I always say is, the grass is always greener on the other side of the library. As soon as you decide on a topic, what seems so doable and so just rich in primary sources, the minute a student hits that first snag where this seems more complicated than it at first appeared, gosh, that other topic I was considering looks so much more attractive. And I try very hard to have people stick with that, to get an idea they like enough to stick with it, because we've all had situations where you bounce around from idea to idea, and all that bouncing is not getting any research done. I'm looking forward to the question and answer part of this, as I hope that will be a very rich part of the discussion. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to this recording of an American Journalism Historians Association conference session, and additional thanks to our sponsor at the University of Georgia. Until next time, I'm your host, Terry Fenneman, signing off with the words of Edward R. Murrow. Good night and good luck.